You're listening to Radio Berkman from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. You can find show notes for this episode and more programs like this at blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman.
Did you hear the news? I'm going to make records.
No kidding.
A hit is still a hit, so that hasn't changed at all. How you discover that hit, it may be a little different. There's more opportunities to discover music, but the quality of that music still has to be great.
Yeah, I'm out that Brooklyn. Now I'm down in Tribeca, right next to the Narrow. But I'll be hood forever. I'm the new Sinatra. And since I made it here, I can make it anywhere. Yeah, they love me everywhere. I used to cop in Harlem. All of my Dominicanos right there up on Broadway. Pulled me back to that McDonald's. Took it to my...
Rapper Jay-Z has released almost a dozen albums, has retired and returned to sell millions more records, and have a net worth of close to $500 million. But did you know that this song, the one you're hearing behind me, Empire State of Mind, from Jay-Z's 2009 record The Blueprint 3, was his first number one single as a headlining artist to hit number one on the Billboard Hot 100? This might come as a surprise. I mean, take Jay-Z, an artist with a nearly two-decade-long career and dozens of hit-worthy songs, only a handful of which have broken the top 10. And compare that to a singer like Justin Bieber, a 17-year-old who just popped onto the scene via a YouTube video in 2009 and hasn't left the top 100 since. These two career trajectories could be seen as microcosms of the sea change that the recording industry has seen in the last two decades with the digital revolution. Careers that once took years to reach a milestone like the number one spot now seem to pop up overnight. It's so easy to produce and distribute music and connect with fans nowadays that you might start to get concerned about the long-term sustainability of artistic careers. After all, what happens when anyone can be an artist? Maybe tomorrow Justin Bieber might get replaced by something like this? That's the recent release by the 13-year-old YouTube sensation Rebecca Black, by the way. Today's guests say the situation for artists has changed, but not as much as you might think. John Platt, the president of EMI Music Publishing's North American creative team, was responsible for signing Jay-Z among countless other chart-topping artists. He's also partly responsible for how the hit Empire State of Mind came into being.
I've told this story so many times. Well, I mean, basically, I was at some of my songwriters' house that we work with, Angela Hunt and Janae Sewell, and they were playing me music. They played this song they had that was kind of roughly titled New York at the time, and it was an R&B song. Had singing verses and everything on the song. Listened to it a couple of times. First time I heard it, I knew it was special. You know, by the second or third time, the music started to really speak to me. That's how it is with me. I'm kind of quirky and weird like that, where, you know, the music actually will sometimes start talking to me, and when it talks to me, I listen. That song started talking to me, and it basically told me it was a song for Jay-Z. I told the girls that. They got on board with it, sent the song to Jay in its current form as the R&B song. Instantly got what it was, heard through the verses that they were singing and everything, and instantly knew what he could contribute to the song. We started talking about feature artists. Alicia Keys' name came up. He went after that. Then, you know, the rest, as they say, is history, or number one. Thank God.
It's such an interesting story, because having heard, you know, Jay-Z's whole back catalog, like, to me, like, it's a surprise that so many of the songs weren't number one.
Number ones are overrated, if you really want to get to it. It's about building a career, you know what I mean? There's a lot of people who have had number ones that we've never heard from again, you know what I mean? I would much rather have Jay's career, where it's a 13, 14-year career, and his first number one coming, you know, in the 13th or 14th year. I'll take that, but he's still a cultural phenomenon, you know what I mean? I'll take that over the person who had the number one in their first year, and we never heard from them again. You know, all you got to do is listen to satellite radio. All you got to listen to the 70s, 80s, and 90s channel. They play a lot of number one records of artists that we've never heard from again. You know what I mean? Be like, oh, yeah, I used to like that song. You know, okay, that's it. You know what I mean? I'd much rather Jay's career.
What is discovery, like new artist discovery, like now? And how has it changed since you first got in?
Well, I mean, you know, a hit is still a hit. So that hasn't changed at all. You know what I mean? How you discover that hit, it may be a little different than before. I don't think it's much different, to be honest with you. You know, there's certainly other avenues for songwriters and artists to get their music heard and get it out there. But again, there's no reshaping of that business, you know, whether it's through the internet or CD or through an attorney or manager or whatever the case may be, of how you get your music to me or anyone on our team. Still, you still got to have great music. You know what I mean? That part hasn't changed at all. There's more opportunities to discover music, but the quality of that music still has to be great.
When you say a hit is still a hit, like the hit is always a hit, is that, are you able to listen to a song and actually be able to to be able to say, this will be, you know, people will want to buy this single. I know when people hear this, you know, we will sell a million.
I would hope that's what I'm talented at. you know, I would hope I'm pretty good at that. But, you know, it's just, to me, people always ask me, what's the difference between a hit and a good song? I was like, the hit is the one you don't have to explain. It explains itself, you know? That's my opinion. But again, you know, just like beauty is in the eye of the beholder, a hit is in the ear of the listener. What is a hit to some is the most terrible song ever wrote, written to other people, you know? But the hit song is pretty much undeniable. A hit song to me is also a song that it may not be your taste in music or whatever, but you're like, wow, that's a really good song. You know what I mean? Like you still respect it, you know?
No, I think that's true. It's just a matter of, I mean, it is a talent. Do you go back and analyze yourself? Like when you, you know, see an artist that you've picked and a song that you've, you know, kind of helped nurture, and you say, you know, how is it that, you know, came together?
No, I mean, I love the story of the song, to be honest with you. And I mean, I guess if your question is, do I police myself to see if I'm right more than I'm wrong? Personally, I think I'm always right. You know what I mean? So, I mean, I never have signed anything where I think it's going to be successful. You know what I mean? I can't approach it like that. You know, has everything I signed been successful? No, absolutely not. But I absolutely am firm in my belief in its success when I sign it. You know what I mean? I can't do it. I've never signed anything that I think is going to be good or I think it's going to have a good run. I sign things that in my mind I know is going to be successful. That's the way I look at it. But I have a different, you know, I have a different background than most. Or than some, I should say. I was a DJ as a kid growing up, you know what I'm saying? And so my job was always to play the music that the people would like. And I still use those instincts today, you know what I mean? When I hear a song, I do that through the years and through the time. I was able to get a really good understanding of people's taste, you know what I mean? And how their relationship to music. Yeah, I'm still able to use that to this very day. Use those instincts to this very day, I should say.
We're coming off of a week where we've just seen, well, there's two big things, I guess, and one is actually more probably legitimate than the other, but of course we have South by Southwest, which is one of the, you know, the biggest single places to discover new music. You have thousands of artists performing 24 hours a day for several days at venues around Austin. And then the other thing that just pops into my mind right now is Rebecca Black, who popped on YouTube last week with a song called Friday. And has accrued in less than a month 24 million views and a ton of exposure. I mean, South by Southwest seems like a place where you're discovering artists in a little bit more of a traditional way. These are folks that, you know, are coming up and performing for you, and you're able to decide what their sound is like based on seeing them in person. And then Rebecca Black is a YouTube star who just popped out of nowhere.
I mean, I think we need both ways, to be honest with you, you know? I think you still need a South by Southwest, you know, and then at the same time, I think it's, you know, with Rebecca Black, I think that's great too. You know what I mean? There's, you know, maybe she wasn't at South by Southwest, you know what I mean? But yet we're still talking about her music as well. I think that's amazing. I mean, everything is different. Every discovery is different. You know what I mean? No one is the same. And the music speaks differently to different people, I guess is what I'm trying to say. So there's no one thing that's the same. You know what I mean? And I'd be foolish to even sit here and tell you that it's that easy. It isn't. You know, there's been things that I've signed that other people didn't think were so great. And I'm sure the same has happened the other way around. And those things have gone on to become successes or not. But there's no, you know, one way. There's no way that I would say, well, yeah, I found this guy playing a banjo on the corner. Or, you know, I was on my computer one day and I was just surfing YouTube and I found this amazing song. Nah, you know what I mean? I'm, you know, it's, you know, I haven't been fortunate enough to stumble upon it like that. You know what I mean? But I have, you know, I have found music when someone is coming to meet with me for one writer and they play me a song and I hear something else that person may have that we weren't even supposed to be meeting about and I sign the person. You know what I mean? So it comes totally different ways. You know, there's no one way to do it. Anybody who tells you that is, they're lucky, put it that way. that's the way it happens for them.
At the same time, as you're talking about the discovery of new artists, there's a lot of folks who are trying to codify what success means and discover, like, if you're looking at like the number of views something gets on YouTube, or, you know, like redefining that kind of stuff. And I've talked with a lot of other folks, like Kim Bu at Lost Highway, who has said, like, really, like, you can't, you know, base success on the number of Twitter followers someone has.
You can't. A hit is still a hit. I mean, you know, someone can get 10 million hits on their for their song or whatever you want to call it, right? You would think that they can equate that into, you know, 10% of that is 1 million sales. You know what I mean? That's not happening for the most part. You know what I mean? So you can't, whoever told you that is 100% correct. Like, you can't quantify it based on the number of hits someone gets on their site or whatever the case may be. You know what I mean? So it's a lot deeper than that, to be honest with you. Now, that being said, once artists figure out the other ways to break their music, you know, then we can have a different conversation. But they haven't completely figured that part of it out yet. You know what I mean? Like, they know how to get their music out there, but how to market it and get it to the consumer to make the consumer reach in their pocket to buy it is a totally different animal altogether.
Are you finding that things are switching from a kind of like an album sales model to you know, a different model of, you know, making sure that artists and publishers make a living?
Well, we're certainly back into a singles market, that's for sure. I think we all can agree on that. There's parts of me that love it, and there's parts of me that don't like it. What I do like about it is that you can truly break an artist now with more than one single. You know what I mean? Where before, or lately, it had been one single, throw the album out, you know, the album is great or not, you know what I mean? And your success rests on what happens with that. You know, I do like the option now of putting a single out, then putting in another single out, then putting another single out and trying to break an artist that way. I'm totally into that as well, you know, and then, you know, the consumer knows what they're getting at that point, you know, and you got to help, and then you brand an artist. You know, the one thing that is lacking in our business right now and the biggest challenge is artist development. You know, they're not, artists aren't being developed anymore. And even the artists that, you know, a lot of the artists now that are having success were built from a different business model, you know, when the time was taken to build these artists and to build and invest in a career.
So when you say development, that means, you know, sticking with an artist, recruiting an artist, and just grooming them through several years as opposed to
Absolutely.
Picking them up and dropping them.
Absolutely, which is pretty much where our business is now. So, you know, a good majority of the people that you see who are having success were built from an old model, you know, where the time was taken to put into those artists and to build a career.
So are we, you know, we're seeing more people who are kind of one-hit wonders?
Well,
and
you know, the proof is in the pudding, to be honest with you, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the reality is, you know, it's become a song business now instead of an artist business, you know, where someone can have a huge song and you don't even really know anything about the artist, you know, and, you know, the song can sell 1 million, 2 million, 3 million singles, you know, and the album comes out and sells like 100,000 copies. And then you never hear from the artist again, potentially, you know, but there's another new song for you to like, and you buy into another song. There's something wrong with that model. You know what I mean? There's something seriously wrong with that model. It's certainly not all bad, because some of those songs or artists, it is what it is, and they should have that opportunity for it to be whatever it is, you know?
We've interviewed a couple artists, Amanda Palmer and Donald Glover, who we kind of figured out they put themselves on the edge of the experimentation. Amanda Palmer, in her case, she's put out a lot of albums that have kind of the Radiohead model, pay what you can to purchase the album. And then Donald Glover, he's also an actor and comedian, and he stars on Community, but for his music, he puts that out completely for free on kind of like pirate file sharing networks. I wonder, on the edges of experimentation, what you've seen that kind of inspires you in terms of, you know, how artists can make a living.
I mean, listen, it all inspires me. You know what I mean? To be honest with you, it all inspires me. Music inspires me. So, you know, however you get that out there, I'm cool with it, to be honest with you. You know, the Donald Glover model, that to me is the epitome of keeping it real. You know what I'm saying? And keeping it real and doing it for the love of the music, you know? So many people claim to want to do that, but then they, you know, get caught up in the business of the music, you know? And somebody who does music, who he's fortunate enough to have another career that supports him, where he can do music and put it out there for people just to consume any way they want to, you know? He's fortunate enough to be able to do that. There are other people who their livelihood will depend on your support of their music financially, you know? There's no one way better than the other. It's up to you which way you want to go at it.
I was curious what you personally are listening to right now and how you have discovered new artists just as a fan, not as a someone who signs artists.
I mean, I listen to a lot of different radio stations, you know. I don't listen to just R&B or hip hop stations or whatever the case may be. I listen to a ton of different radio stations. So, I mean, some of the left field, you know. I mean, of course, you know, R&B and hip hop is kind of the obvious. You know what I mean? So I'm not gonna do. I'll tell you, like I love Ray LaMontagne's album. So, I mean, I think that's an amazing album. You know what I mean? It doesn't really get much better than that. Adele, another amazing album. You know what I mean? I think her voice on this album is incredible. I think the songs are good. You know, border, you know, approaching great. But the more important, what strikes me on this album is her voice and the way she sings with so much passion. And it's just, I haven't heard that in a long time from a new artist. And I mean, you know, of course, this is her second album, but. You know, I discovered that just on satellite radio, just Chasing Pavements. I would just hear this song all the time on satellite radio. I was like, yeah, that's a really good song. That's a really good song. And then I finally got the album. I was like, this is a really good album. And, you know, I became a fan of hers. And I listen to a lot of old stuff, too, to be honest with you. I listen to a lot of old music, rock, pop, jazz, R&B, everything. I just, it keeps me firmly grounded and where I want to go today, because again, like I said, a hit song is still a hit song, and it makes me discipline myself to not settle, and it to push writers to not settle.
Well, thanks so much for taking the time to be on Radio Berkman today, John.
All right, no problem, man.
John Platt is the president of EMI Music Publishing's North American creative team.
Sugarfoot called me last night. He said his girl called him. She said, can I come over? She said, yeah.
A hit might still be a hit, but ensuring the success of that hit is as hard as it ever was. If you've got a great song on your hands, there's no simple factory you can put it through to make sure it gets as broad an audience as possible. But in a market that is in some ways becoming increasingly regional and increasingly nichified, there are still a few tricks. Kim Buey is the vice president of A&R for Lost Highway Records out of Nashville, Tennessee. They're the home to artists like Willie Nelson, Lucinda Williams, Tom Jones, and Black Joe Lewis, whose new record, Scandalous, just debuted at number one on the Billboard Blues charts. Kim and I spoke about the formula for musical success in the digital age, or the lack thereof.
You can make a very good career in the margins of our business. What it means is you have to work a little bit harder for every dollar. You know, it used to be that you would go to several outlets for maximum exposure. Radio, depending on your format, any given format, whether it was, you know, college radio and top 10 at college radio was worth, you know, X amount of units, roughly, you know, 20 to 30,000 units, you know, but a hit at alternative radio or pop radio or urban radio can yield you hundreds of thousands of units sold. Nowadays, it's really about, you know, nickels and dimes and pennies, licensing income, limited radio exposure, digital outlets, even nighttime television does not have the kind of impact that you would think. So it really used to be about connecting the dots, and the major dots were press, radio, retail. Now the dots are just all over the place. It's just, we're littered with dots. And you do everything that you possibly can to make as many impressions as you possibly can. Our artists can sell anywhere from 60 to 360,000 units. And if the dollars are managed and how much that you spend on making the record and how much you spend marketing that record, 60,000 units can actually yield you a pretty good return. You know, 200,000 units, that's a fantastic career. It's not just that they've sold that many more records, because quite frankly, that's probably the least of it. It's all of a sudden they've increased their publishing return, they've increased their touring opportunities, they've increased their merchandising sales. I mean, all of that has a direct impact on every other aspect of their business as artists.
Do you find that you're taking on a lot more artists than you used to because what you're describing as this this model of impressions, you know, reaching out with the artist, it's a lot more affordable?
We're taking on less. I mean,
you're taking on fewer.
Mm-hmm. We're taking on fewer because we're selling less. So when we take something on, we want to have some idea that we believe there's an upside, or that there will be an upside. You know, artist development is one of the most difficult, you know, aspects of our business now. And it's the thing that I love to do the most. Everyone is fighting for the same exposure. There are a few truths that never diminish, and that is, the more the artist can do for themselves in their own region, forget about trying to be nationally successful. Start by trying to be regionally successful, because that's manageable. You know, so if you live in Nashville, you can get to Birmingham, Alabama. You can get to Atlanta and Athens and Columbus and Cincinnati and Louisville and building a fan base. If you're able to do that, then you've already achieved some degree of success. So the next step is going to be then taking the money that you've earned and, you know, hiring the most kick-ass publicist you could possibly find to help you broaden your reach, to get a better booking agent, to help you go national, to, you know, all these things that artists want but can't get, but they become more achievable when you start building something regionally. I think, you know, one can speculate and predict as much as they want, but there are a few things that just never change. You know, you have to be able to deliver live what you are able to record. You don't necessarily need all the bells and whistles, because a great song is a great song is a great song.
The way you're describing it, it actually sounds like, you know, things really haven't changed all that much. For an independent artist, the things you have to do, connect with fans, tour, put out good music, sound good. Like these are things that haven't changed that much. Is that the way it is, or are there a lot more opportunities for independent artists to become successful more easily than they used to? Like it's like a lot of hard work to do that work, you know, the touring and the
yeah,
sounding good.
I was gonna say, I don't know how easy it is. I don't think anything is easy anymore.
Well, I think of Justin Bieber, who, you know, those kinds of perhaps anomalies of the music world that are, you know, just put out a YouTube video and somehow they get picked up, they get heard. I mean, I don't know if anybody wants to make a business model out of that, or if that is, you know, people are looking at it and saying, wow, that we can do that too.
Yeah, you know, I mean, if everyone could do that, it would be a lovely world. But, you know, I think those are the rarities. But I think people always look to those as like, hey, let's do that. But it doesn't quite work out that way. I mean, I think short of that miraculous discovery, you have to be willing to put in the work. And you have to be willing to, you know, all those truisms that I'm talking about, you know, the fun or the creative aspect to that is then, you know, how do you use the new media to your advantage to start building your impressions? And YouTube is part of it. Touring is part of it. MySpace, Facebook, Twitter. But, you know, you could tweet your little heart out and it's not going to make a difference in whether people care or not. I mean, I've seen plenty of artists who say, I'm going to give my record away. It's like, okay, great. So you'll earn nothing and who's going to want it? Just because you're giving it away doesn't mean people want it. You have to create a demand. You have to have something that people desire. But to answer your question, there is no doubt that the ability for an artist to reach people faster exists. Let's put it this way. If an artist does all those things that I'm talking about and the fans start to love it and want it, that's when all those tools begin to really kick in. You know, that's when, you know, having your MySpace and Facebook and your tweeting become valuable because you have fans that want it and that will eat it up. You know, you have merchandise that you can sell, so feed more merchandise. You know, then you begin to start, you know, thinking of how many different ways you want to package it and so everybody gets something special and you're going to make, you know, 3,000 limited edition, you know, hand-stamped, hand-pressed, hand-painted, hand-doodled, you know, CDs, and you'll charge a higher price for it, and you'll throw in a sticker for free, and or maybe there'll be a fold-up poster that goes with it. But that's when all that becomes valuable. That's when you really start serving the fan. You have to build a following. You have to build a base. You have to start somewhere.
I look at the roster of Lost Highways artists, and they're a group of artists, some of whom are known for a lot more of a kind of a less technological bent, if I might put it that
sure.
way. And then a lot who sort of angle a lot older, to a lot older audience. You've got Tom Jones, you've got Elvis Costello, who, you know, a lot of young people also like, but is definitely an older artist, and Willie Nelson. And I wonder, you know, how this works for your artists in particular, if you've got any examples of
sure.
of artists who've been able to use this.
Well, Black Joe Lewis is a great example of a band that skews very young, it's definitely youth oriented. I mean, when you look at like the sales for an artist like Lucinda Williams, where you're over 50% on the physical, but then you look at Black Joe Lewis and your digital sales exceed 50%, you know, that in itself begins to show you that you're dealing with a different fan base and you're dealing with a different audience. For Black Joe Lewis, I mean, when we signed them, he had only had less than a, you know, basically 1,000 copies of a CD that had only really been sold locally. And so when we signed them, we knew that it was going to be tough because we were developing something from scratch. Word of mouth and really building out their touring base has made all these other things possible. I mean, you know, they went from 1,000 units to all of a sudden, you know, in their first record, touring with Gomez, with Robert Randolph, with Lucero and New York Dolls. They also did two tours of Europe and did Australia. Oh, yeah, and they also played with Acreville River. Sorry, I forgot about that one. And then Spoon. For a seven-piece band, it's amazing we were able to get that much touring out of them. And it had a lot to do with having good management and having a booking agent who got really creative, and the band taking on some private gigs because it meant that it would help pay for the deficit of regular touring and support touring. On top of that, they've just been really proactive in communicating with their fans, and the web experience has been as important to them as traditional means of exposure have.
Yeah, I'm looking at his at Black Joe Lewis's Twitter right now, and it looks like he has, or they have almost 57,000 followers. And just looking through the stream, there's an equal mix of like fun tweets and more, you know, come to our show types of tweets and, you know, responses to other folks. Like it looks like a real engaging artist.
It was hilarious because someone in our office just had this idea that he was going to send a care package to Chad Ochocinco and sent it just to the stadium, to the office, you know, not really knowing if he'd really get the package or not. And then one day this tweet shows up from Chad Ochocinco saying, you know, thanks to Chris Fabiani for sending me the care package. And all the CDs were laid out on a table, and Chad Ochocinco had taken a picture of it, and right there was Black Joe Lewis. And so, of course, Joe, he is a giant sports fan, huge, just was... couldn't believe that Chad Ochocinco had a CD. So he retweeted it to his fans, you know. So, you know, it's just it's silly but fun things like that. But, you know, they absolutely skew young. And so it's different. But then you get somebody like Lucinda Williams, who is totally engaged in having the Facebook experience. She loves going on Facebook and communicating directly with her fans. Half the time her fans are thinking, this isn't really Lucinda. And she's like, yeah, no, it really is me. And it is. I mean, I know it is because she talks about it. But, you know, I'd probably be just as skeptical if I was a person on the other end saying,
right,
I'm Lucinda. And I'd be like, yeah, right, this isn't Lucinda. But
you get a lot of fans who actually take their, you know, the artists to task because they hire a professional tweeter, like Britney Spears' professional tweeter. I'm not sure how many professional tweeters she has on her staff, but, you know, mm-hmm. people just take it as a given that she doesn't do it herself.
Yeah, exactly. And you begin to sort of sniff it out anyway. The fans are smart.
You were describing this kind of like retweet exchange between Black Joe Lewis and Ochocinco. And you describe it as kind of like a funny interaction, but I wonder if is there pressure from the representation and the higher ups to quantify that kind of engagement and that kind of experience to say, well, as a result of this kind of exchange or as a result of having 57,000 Twitter followers, we can say we'll sell this many tickets or we'll sell this many CDs.
No, unfortunately, you can't. I mean, I'll tell you where you can quantify. We all pretty much understand at this point that nighttime television doesn't really sell records. Maybe you'll see a small spike, you know, 500 to 1,000 units, maybe. College radio, you know, number one on college radio might be worth 10 to 15,000 units, maybe. So, you know, you can quantify those things. But, like, believe it or not, satellite radio can't quantify it. You know, AAA radio, we know it doesn't have a big impact. Non-com radio, you can definitely see the impact. You know, if you're getting, you know, strong rotation at WXPN in Philly or KCRW in LA, you will see a bump in that market, and you can quantify it with that. You get a part of a national ad campaign. And consumers are able to connect the dots between that song on the commercial and the song by the artist. You can notice a sales bump. But when you're talking about tweets and blog postings and press, print, and digital, it's really, 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 really hard to quantify.
Is that something that's frustrating for those who would be responsible for the bean counting at the label?
No, I think it's just kind of understood. And that's why I go back and say that, you know, it's all about impressions. It used to be you didn't have to make as many impressions to see a result. Nowadays, you just need to catch every impression you possibly can.
Yeah, the reason it's something of a curiosity. It seems because that you're spending so much time and you're telling the artist perhaps to spend so much time, you know, unless they're, you know, completely motivated to do it on their own already, you're asking the artist, this is the way, you know, these are some ways you can engage with the fans, and you want to be able to say the reason you should be doing this is because we'll see you become more successful. But it sounds like from what you're describing that actually isn't the way it is. You're not telling the artist to do this. This is something that...
No, but there are certain things that we'll look at before we make a decision to sign an act. I mean, you know, the one thing, that, you know, another absolute quantifier is when an artist goes in a market and plays, you see a sales spike, whether it was at their merch table. I mean, you know, our marketing guys say this all the time, and they're absolutely right, which is the artist is as valuable to us, not only for their art, but as being their own retailer. What an artist does in a performance directly reflects what happens at the merch table, which then gets counted at SoundScan and, becomes an important part of the impressions that they're making. Less common nowadays that for at least the developing act, that you'll see a great show and that you won't find them at the merch table after the show. And it's not a bad thing at all. It's fantastic because they're making connection with their fans. So whether it's at their merch table or whether it's a combination at the local record store or Amazon or download, you will see percentage increases.
How are you discovering new music? You talk about all these new ways that fans are discovering music. How are you discovering new music or new artists that you might want to sign to the label as well?
The only thing that's changed for me is that I have a number of ways in which I can get turned on. So it's not just somebody sending a package in for me to listen to. Now it's getting a quick impression. I'm going to a MySpace page or a Facebook or getting a drop IO through friends, through something that I read, through something that I just stumbled across.
So has that stayed pretty consistent? Or has there been one kind of revolutionary new way in the last, 10 years or so that you've been able to, like, that's really surprised you?
I don't think anything surprised me, but I think I have more conveniences now. I mean, I love being able to just go on MySpace and stream something and getting a really quick impression. Because if I love it, I will reach out to them and say, can I have more, please? I love the ease and speed in which I can do that. What I don't enjoy is when somebody wants me to do the work for them. They'll send me a link. I got to download some stuff. There are no song titles. There's no image. There's no impression. It drives me crazy. It's like one or two songs is not going to tell a story. No matter what media I am actually listening to something on, this is still true for me, and that is that I want an artist with a point of view who has something to say that's distinctive on a number of levels, musically and vocally. You could have the best song in the world, but if the singer can't deliver it, then I'm not going to hear it.
Just speaking from my own experience, I definitely have these like core artists that I'll go back to and I'll keep going back to. And it's interesting that actually a lot of the artists that I love are no longer working. People like Elliott Smith or Nirvana or Johnny Cash, folks that just aren't around anymore. And I just am in love with their music and I'll listen to the tracks over and over again. By the same token, there are artists that I've hated right off the bat, but they've charmed me through watching them on talk shows or seeing how they engage with people on Twitter or on blogs. John Mayer is one person that I begrudgingly enjoy for that very reason.
He's a guilty pleasure. Absolutely. There is something very, you almost admire his courage and his sense of drama. He's funny. That's true. I mean, the thing that's the most difficult is just people understanding that the song is still important. You know, you can be as shocking and daring and all, you know, as you want to be, but if the song isn't good, then, you know, it's just a bunch of noise.
Well, thank you so much for your time, Kim.
Yeah, absolutely.
Kim Buey is the vice president of A&R for Lost Highway Records out of Nashville, Tennessee, the home of artists like Willie Nelson, Lucinda Williams, Tom Jones, and Black Joe Lewis. Kim and I also talked about future models for the music management business. You can hear more of our conversation over at our website, blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman. And while you're there, check out our show notes for links to other shows in our Rethinking Music series. The Rethink Music Conference is coming up from April 25th to the 27th in Boston. If you enjoyed these conversations, you might want to think about showing up. You can find out more at rethink-music.com. This week's episode of Radio Berkman was produced by me, Daniel Dennis Jones, with John Platt, Kim Buey, Amar Asher, Alan Bargfried, Chris Babbitts, and prodigal host David Weinberger from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts.